in those ancient days when the good destinies had been decreed, and after An and Enlil had set up the divine rules of heaven and earth, then the Lord of Broad Wisdom, Enki, the Master of Destinies, found the dwelling places. He took in his hand waters to encourage and create good seed. He laid out side by side the Tigris and the Euphrates, and caused them to bring water from the mountains. He scoured out the smaller streams and positioned the other water courses. Enki made spacious sheepfolds and cattle pens and provided shepherds and herdsmen. He founded cities and settlements throughout the earth and made the black-headed multiply. He provided them with a king as shepherds, elevating him to sovereignty over them. The king rose as the daylight over the foreign countries. The debate between bird and fish. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me, and if this is your first episode, welcome. We had a surprisingly high number of downloads last week, and I think there are some new people in those, and I hope you all will continue to listen and enjoy. And my returning listeners, I hope the same for you as well. So today, my goal is to finish up our urbanization specials for this season. And what I think this will probably be the last kind of, bridge episode, I guess, for lack of a better term, for a little while, for this, probably for this season. We might do like a general thing as well a little bit later, but my goal right now is for this to be the final episode, and then we'll continue on back to our more normal format, where we go region by region, people by people, and then of course continue on for this season's time frame. Before that, though, I did have a point I should have made last week, both for clarity and because it plays into our discussions this week, and will be, you know, kind of a point going into what is now the historical period, or what will be becoming the historical period. And that is, just as a reference, Plato and Aristotle's understanding of urban and city formation. They were working, much like Child after them, with what they had at the time, which were historical records, folk history, personal experiences and expertise, and of course the myths that the Greeks were familiar with, or I guess the religious teachings that they had as a frame of reference. Now we've talked about the historicity of folk record, personal experience, and things like that, and myths when we talked about the original peoples, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia. And the same thing applies to other peoples as to the Aborigines. So while Plato and Aristotle may not have accepted all their religious myths as 100% actual, factual, historic events, they probably accepted them at least as partly true, and valued at least, you know, the big ones, because they understood them as having value because people believed them and accepted them. And whether they believed a mythological event were true, partly true, or completely made up, they understood that those stories were important building blocks of their society and civilization. Hence, they based their philosophy and understandings on these assumptions and knowledge. And earlier historians, philosophers, and people do the same thing all over the world. And, you know, latter ones will as well, yours truly included. So, while they might be wrong with some of their facts about the origins of the cities, they were not broadly incorrect. In fact, their beliefs about the cities in Greece proper being the conglomerate of smaller towns and villages, that is broadly correct, at least from what we can see in the archaeological record. But we'll talk more about those cities later, though. For now, we should talk about the cities that emerge at the earliest points of this season. And for those earliest parts of this season, which 6,000 to 5,000 BC, we will see two primary locations where cities are being founded or see that final conglomeration of towns and villages into a single unit, I guess, for lack of a better term. And then, of course, going forward, we'll hit that point definitely by the start of the following millennium, so 5,000 to 4,000, where you'll see a number of neighboring cities come about. And these sites were in southern Mesopotamia and in the Indus River Valley. Now, of course, there are other future sites and regions where settlement begins around this time, but these locations take a little longer to reach what we would today consider a city. Some of them will be talked about in this episode and season, but others won't be talked about until later. It depends on if they're super important or if they just have interesting facts about them. I'll kind of include them as needed. Now, in Mesopotamia, Anatolia, and the Mediterranean coast, or I should say the Mediterranean eastern coast in the modern Levant region, a lot of the early semi-permanent settlements and agricultural sites were in ectones, usually in the foothills, near small rivers or streams, or in areas where rainfall was plentiful. However, these sites were not able to fully support the rapidly expanding populations. And this was due to a number of issues, including climate change, which led to a drier, less rain-prone climate for more of the year, as opposed to, you know, wetter periods. There are, of course, lack of other resources. The land's carrying capacity gets reached, etc. And in some cases, it was a combination of, you know, all those factors and maybe a couple of others. But those are the primary ones in the Mesopotamian, Anatolian, Levant region. Now, some groups would split from these sites and travel to areas with, you know, similar geography and climates, and they found other smaller sites and start this process all over again. However, other groups begin to migrate to and establish villages closer to the plains and marshes, and much closer to larger, more powerful bodies of water. Or maybe I should say that there may be undiscovered sites that are contemporary with these hilly and mountainous settlements that have been buried under the earth by, you know, the shifting of rivers and things like that. So they may be contemporaneous with earlier sites like Çatalhöyük, Göbekli Tepe, but if they existed, we haven't found evidence of them. Whatever the exact case is, with access to the rivers and marshes for irrigation, and, you know, the alluvial soil being transported from the highlands and mountains by these larger rivers, these lowland villages were able to not just keep their population stable, but to grow exponentially faster than what had been seen before. And they were able to do this, but they were also still able to save portions of their harvest for use in winter and in times of crisis. They were able to do this without having to send sizable portions of their populations away to found new settlements. They would still do that, of course, to establish, you know, access or control of other resources that they didn't have, but they didn't have to do this. They did this as something of a, maybe of a convenience. Now, these sites also saw something happening we don't really see all that much in hunter-gatherer societies or in small villages. And this is social separation and stratification. Now, in sites without writing or engravings or very abstract art, this is judged based on comparing how contemporary people were buried, what condition they were in when they died, where and what they're buried with. Typically, in stratified societies, more important people were buried with more grave goods or other things that make them stand out. It also could be the case that, or it might not be a case of class. You might see people that may have had different careers or trades buried in distinct ways from each other. Each may have been interred, you know, in a manner considered completely respectable and dignified for them. So, you know, a farmer might not be buried with weapons. He might be buried with just his hand axe, or, you know, he might, you know, have been buried close to land that he worked, that kind of thing. Whereas a warrior, you might say, or a hunter, you might see him buried with more items because he used those items more frequently than a farmer would have. The next factor you see that separates these sites from smaller towns and villages is the issues of organization. Due to the large and still growing population, organization was needed to make sure that, you know, things like the cycles of plowing, planting, maintaining, and harvesting were being performed as efficiently and productively as possible. You also have to mention that several other tasks, including helping settling disputes between various neighboring communities and individuals, was done. You have to keep track of surplus and making sure that, you know, enough food is being saved for winter and the future. You also have to make sure that those surpluses are protected. So you would choose... So I ask, who would you choose for these very important and significant tasks? Well, the first Mesopotamian people to found cities, the Sumerians, and then later their neighbors, chose gods for this task. Now, a god's house, and the term the Sumerians used was E, or E, was possibly... or I should say it was possibly pronounced as Hash at first, and then it got shortened over time. This word was the same word that they used for their homes. A god's house was A, just as a human's house was. These gods' houses were constructed as important meeting and gathering places for the nearby villages and towns, and the city's infrastructure, at least in their earliest periods, spread from these focal points and connected the new city's various neighborhoods with it, and, of course, with their, you know, various territories and farmlands and things like that. As time goes on, each grew closer and closer together. Now, as time progressed and the city got larger, the god's house was expanded or moved to another part of the city that was maybe more conducive to overseeing things. And once this happens, the temples would in general be called Egal, or big house, though later all temples would have had a specific proper name. The first Sumerian city, or at least the oldest one we know, and the oldest one mentioned in Sumerian records and copies of Sumerian records, was Eridu, or as the Sumerians may have said, Eriduk. And its primary god, and the first with a home in the city, was Enki. And as an example of proper names of temples, his temple in Eridu was referred to as either the Eabzu or as Eingura, depending on, you know, the time frame you're talking about it may have gone by different names. Now, Eridu was expressed in cuneiform with two symbols, Nun and Ki, which together meant, they were written together, and that meant it was referring to that city. Now, Sumerian, their writing system is logographic, so this might confuse some listeners, as the Latin alphabet is not logographic. But if you're familiar with East Asian writings or writing systems, you'll probably understand, or at least have a better time understanding what I'm trying to convey. I think, as an example, Japanese, I think kanji is their logographic writing system. I'm pretty sure it's kanji. I think kana is the other one. But regardless, all symbols in cuneiform, every symbol represent whole words. The symbol nun meant first, best, or foremost. And ki meant land, place, earth, etc. So these two symbols written together meant Eridu, even though neither word is close to how Eridu or Eridug was pronounced. And we'll talk more about this when we get to our episodes on the Sumerians. Of course, writing is still in the future. It's after this season, I think, for sure. Enki's name probably means Lord of Earth. En was a title used by historical individuals, not just gods, and it has been translated the way En has been translated, as Lord by speakers of several different languages. And as we mentioned before, the cuneiform word Ki is earth or land, hence Lord of the Earth. I would like to talk more about Enki and the Sumerian religion, but I need to make sure that I kind of save that for later. I want to talk about that kind of stuff when we talk about the Sumerians more specifically. But I just wanted to bring it up just kind of in general now, so you have a little bit better idea of how the cities were organized, at least in Sumeria. Now, we don't really know at the earliest periods how the cities were governed. Of course, at later times, we understand that priests or inns, as they were called, lords, they were very important, and they would be in charge of the cities themselves, though we don't know, at least initially, it doesn't appear as this is a hereditary role, but it's likely that these priests were not the sole authority. They probably definitely had a very important religious function, but religious, in a city where you're ruled by a god, religious functions and political functions and governing functions are all kind of tied in together. So most likely the priests were very influential. But whether or not they directly controlled day-to-day operations, or if they were kind of a first among equals of a number of different roles, maybe chosen by, different groups or different neighborhoods, or from people performing the tasks that they're overseeing, and then, of course, the priests, have to give their blessing or that kind of thing, we're not really sure. But once you get to the historical period, it's definitely a case of seeing that the inns had basically become kind of the supreme authority. And this will eventually change. Eventually you'll get different titles for kings, like true, as we would think about them, kings. And the kings kind of take over a lot of the religious functions. Though, even at that period, the priests do a lot of the daily functions of religion, and the priests, or the kings, kind of oversee. Eventually, the priests become the very top, the kings become the very top of the pyramid, or at the very top of a government, and they kind of take on all the roles of the people under them. Though, again, depending on the city and at the time, this could be more direct than at other periods, where it may be more ceremonial. But that's all stuff we'll talk about later. Now, when we say that the gods had a house, that was literally and figuratively, there would always be a statue or representation of a god in their temple. It was treated as the god on earth. They would make offerings to the idols. They would make sure that the gods had food available, that they were covered, or that they had, you know, clothing. At some points, you'll see, you know, that they would have had makeup or things that would have, you know, been something that, you know, any person of any kind of high status would have. And generally, the god statue would have the best. And that's kind of all throughout Mesopotamian society. And this is something you see in other places too. Now, I should point out that the Sumerians of Eridu, we don't know the exact relation between all the Sumerian cities, at least at the earliest period. Were all these people, you know, colonies sent out from Eridu, and they would eventually found all these other cities? Or were these other Sumerian peoples, you know, cousins to the Eridu or Eridugs? And, you know, they began founding their own cities with their local gods. And they just kind of copied the idea from Eridu. They felt this was a good way to organize. We're really, really not sure. With these kind of houses of the gods, these temples as their focus, a lot of these cities, you know, they begin to formalize and stratify in a way, much like their societies. They begin to stratify their territories. We'll talk about it more in the future, but that's, you know, they make firm claims on what land belongs to their city, to their god, to do with as that god pleases. And again, this is something that becomes a major issue in a number of these city-states going forward in, again, next season. Although, obviously, there are instances taking place in this season that we maybe just don't have records about. Other, of course, parts of the city, you'll see irrigation starting to be dug to make sure that your crops and your fields have enough water. There's always kind of a playoff between, you know, making sure your city has enough farmland, but also keeping enough land that's available for grazing for sheep, goats, things like that. Most cities, in fact, all of them, as far as I know, at least for the Sumerians, they all prioritize farmland over grazing land. And that's probably not just a Sumerian thing. I think that's pretty much all of the Mesopotamian peoples. And in general, all cities, really. You know, meat's a very nice dish, but it's not something that everyone has access to. It's usually fairly expensive, unless, you know, your city is just doing very, very well and can choose to import or supplement, you know, get other sources of it. And of course, you're not getting rid of your hunters and gatherers. They're just living in the cities now. They're more stable. And, you know, you do have people that are going out and fishing and, you know, harvesting wild sources of food as well. You'll also begin to see people getting metals, copper, and later copper, tin, everything you need to make bronze, all that kind of stuff. Now, and again, the Sumerians, of course, have their own kind of region at the very southern part of the Mesopotamia, where the Tigris and Euphrates enter the Persian Gulf. and that is, again, it's still further inland than it is today. Eridu now is like in the middle of a very dry, deserty part of Iraq, but in the past, it was very close to the ocean. It was only a few miles from the ocean, I believe. It might have been even closer. But there are other peoples, neighbors to the Sumerians, that are seeing a rise in villages and towns and things like that. And eventually these people are going to form their own cities. We'll talk about them later. But neighbors to the Sumerians do have their own proto-urbanizing movements happening. But it appears that they do kind of base their organizations on the Sumerians, probably because they saw how successful the Sumerians were. And each city of the Sumerians will have their own god that the city is dedicated to. There are, in some cases, eventually cities will have multiple gods residing in them, or at least multiple houses. The god may or may not be there, depending on war or things like that. But we'll, again, dive into all this later. So in addition to these temple complexes, you also have roads begin to be worked on, or at least they're not paved necessarily, but they are, you know, they're very clearly, distinctly made for easy travel, because there's no horses or anything like that at this period. You also see, of course, bigger and bigger city walls become important. And this is not just a factor of keeping people out. This is not just a matter of keeping your neighbors out of your city. It's also a matter of keeping your people in. There's always a need for workforce in these type of cities, especially when the temples need to produce these big works. You may not have enough labor on hand if you also have to make sure that you're maintaining your fields and your herds. So you'll see slavery become much more prevalent. And if, you know, if the conditions are especially harsh, people do try to leave these cities and go live out in the countryside. And there's always a hard time of making sure these urban centers have enough labor. So they're supplemented not just with other Sumerians, but also slaves, who could be other Sumerians, but they were also from neighboring peoples. Sometimes these were people bought and sold like that. Sometimes these are people captured in battle. All that is part and parcel of these very early civilizations. And speaking of battle and defending your territory, armies become a thing. Now, these are not very large at the earliest periods. They probably didn't have, you know, too much in terms of resources to support large armies. Nothing like a standing army. There might be like a few like full-time warriors, professional fighters, or men who are just very physically gifted. But for the large part, you're probably looking at seasonal work or like a seasonal call-up if necessary. These armies would not be very well-armed. They'd probably just have whatever clothes they would have on their back. They'd have, you know, probably good shoes if possible. The weapons they would have would be very simple. Wooden spears, stone tips, arrows, bows, clubs. Clubs are really big at this earlier period. The symbol of kingly authority, the mace, is just a fancy club with a metal head. Those don't exist yet, so they just probably have large, hard wooden clubs, or maybe a club that has had a stone affixed to it, like a heavy weighted stone. No swords. make probably some daggers, though. You probably wouldn't, I would imagine you wouldn't fight with those earlier daggers very much. You'd probably just use that for, like, you know, cutting and tying and things like that. But probably in a, you know, you know, worst case scenario, a knife might be better than nothing. Unfortunately, we don't know how these were organized, if it was like a maybe a neighborhood system or a tribal system. It's just really hard to say. We don't know. Now, moving out of Mesopotamia, let's move a little bit further to the east and talk about what will become the Indus Valley Civilization, specifically the site of Marigar. Now, we talked about Marigar a lot last season. It is still existing at our time frame. And around 5000 BC, maybe a little bit before, maybe a little bit after, Marigar probably hits that point where it's a city. It hits that urbanization point where the population is concentrated. Now, sadly, we don't know much about Marigar in terms of how it was organized. And we can't really make any guesses on later periods because we don't know, or we haven't been able to decipher the writing of the Indus Valley Civilization. A lot of what we know about these earlier Sumerian periods, we've been able to kind of put together based on the structure of the next couple of millennia after this happened, because we have writings, we know what they say, we know the stories of how these things are said to have evolved. We do not have that for Marigar. And Marigar does, and all Indus Valley civilizations, do not appear to have these large temple complexes. There's no sign of being organized around like the worship of a specific god or its idol. It's very possible that was done, but we don't have any proof of that. We don't have any record of that. But of course, later there are big centralized buildings in the Indus Valley cities, but their purpose is not known, unfortunately. And in some cases, they appear to be very large, very fancy baths. So there could have been an element of like ritual cleanness, but we just don't have too much in the way of specifics, unfortunately. And it's really a mystery. We don't know, again, how Marigar was related to the Indus Valley civilization. They definitely had contacts with each other, but again, we don't have writing. We don't know if they saw themselves as being the same people. We don't know if the Indus Valley civilization was maybe founded by neighbors of Marigar. Later Indus Valley civilization sites, they do have a lot of uniformity in terms of like their building material, their building sizes, their dimensions. Marigar doesn't really have that because it is so much older. And it is abandoned, at least largely abandoned, by the time the Indus civilization is in kind of its middle stages. So Marigar may not have been in the best of shape. It could have been abandoned naturally. It could have been maybe just kind of outcompeted by the much more organized Indus Valley peoples. It's really, really hard to say. But it does show that the Indus civilizations are working kind of on a different organization, at least as far as we can tell. That's kind of the interpretation. It's organized differently than what you'll see in Mesopotamia. It's really a fascinating subject, and I really like learning more about that. Of course, there's a lot of problems. You get a lot of fringe and pseudo-archaeologists and, like, ultra nationalist Hindu groups in India making all these really wild claims about the Indus Valley civilization, like they invented nukes and things like that, and that their religious texts are describing like nuclear wars and stuff. But that's all extremely fringe. It's just like one of those ancient alien stuff kind of deals. Like another thing that we'll talk about when we probably talk about Sumerian civilization, there are people who think like the Mesopotamian gods are like really aliens, like the Anunnaki are like really aliens and all that kind of stuff. But we'll go into that when we talk about Sumerian religion. It's just one of those things that, you know, kind of make it hard sometimes to dive into like the really interesting parts of history as opposed to the more fantastical parts. Now, in terms of the other big ancient civilizations of, or at least in the old world, Egypt, China, and places like that, their cities do not form really until after this season. Now, they are becoming more and more sedentary, but they don't really hit that catalyst and, you know, form these large, really dense civilizations until a little bit after this season, at least as far as I'm aware. In fact, a lot of the permanent settlements that we see in China, or what is now China, they aren't occupied at this point. They are occupying places, but those places don't grow into these big cities. That's something that happens, I think, at the start of next season. So they're kind of in the phase where it's like Chattahoyuk and Göbekli Tepe. They're getting close to it, but for whatever reason, these sites that they're living in now just aren't quite conducive to forming these large urban settlements. Now, for Egypt, a little bit different situation. Where we are now in terms of human technology and Egypt's environment, which, while certainly much greener at this season than it is in today's world, still, it's not the most conducive to forming large settlements, at least outside of the Nile. There are probably, all up and down the Nile, there are probably tons and tons of little villages and small towns, you know, just dotting the Nile at this period. But you don't really see cities come about until you get to the pre-dynastic period. And even then, at the end of that period, there's just not enough, there's just not much of an ability yet for humans to form larger settlements there. Now, eventually they'll get better irrigation techniques and things like that that will allow some larger cities or some towns to form into cities. But from my understanding is none of the major cities in Egypt, even when Egypt is at its greatest and most powerful, they're kind of limited on how big they can actually get. But they do end up having a lot of these little cities kind of dotting, going up and down the Nile. So Egypt, despite their cosmopolitan areas being very rich, wealthy, well-organized, they may not have the largest cities because there just isn't a way to support them. But that's stuff we'll talk about later. There are very old cities that are even today continuously inhabited, but those don't show up until, at least as far as we can tell, those aren't inhabited until around 3,000-ish. So they'll show up next season. Now, there are a couple of sites in Europe that have been continuously inhabited from this season, from the 6,000 to 4,000 range. However, these sites will not become true cities until later. They won't reach that probably if not next season, then the following season. But these sites are all very close to Anatolia. They're probably being founded by a mix of, you know, Anatolian farmers migrating, trying to find better weather and land from, like, the drying climate in Anatolia. They're getting to Greece and Bulgaria. Athens, people start living where Athens is sometime between 5 and 4,000 BC. Thebes, ancient Thebes, it's being occupied around 5,000. There's another site, I forget the name. It's not like one of the major ones. But you also have, in the Peloponnese, you have Argos, which is going to be like one of the first major mainland Greek cities that kind of has like a real presence on the world, or, you know, in the political stage. That's being, people are starting to move there around 5,000 BC and living there. And again, these are very small at this point. They don't become cities until, you know, probably mid-Bronze Age, if that. Like, some of them don't even become major settlements until the very, very end of the Bronze Age, the very start of the Iron Age. But that's all for future stuff. So, right now, in terms of true, what I think most people today would consider urban environments, you've got two places to look at. Sumeria, which again is southern Mesopotamia, modern day South Iraq, and what is now modern Pakistan, probably parts of India too, maybe. But that's all stuff we're going to, of course, dive into much more detail going forward. So, I think that's kind of the highs I wanted to hit for this week. I'm trying to think if I left anything out in terms of other parts of infrastructure. Of course, trash piles, middens. Very important for archaeologists. They love it when they can find old used up trash piles. They're very good sources of information. Let's see. Armies, roads, complexes. Yeah, no, I think that's kind of the high points. Of course, this should all, again, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt, because there are areas that may be under, you know, just tons and tons of dried out alluvium or mud because of shifting rivers over time, all that kind of stuff. But this is what we have found so far. So, like Aristotle, like Plato, like V. Gordon Child, we're kind of working with what we have. So, if any future generations are listening to this, just be aware that this is what I have access to. This is what I can kind of get a hold of. And that goes for you, my listeners, as well. I think this is a good place to kind of stop it. We're getting close to the 45-minute mark here. If you have any questions or feedback or anything along those lines, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on Twitter. You can contact me via YouTube. You can comment on any of the videos. I will get them eventually, even if I don't read them same day. I'd like to respond. I had a very nice comment a little bit earlier this week. Someone had asked me about the name of the podcast, because it is a little long and unwieldy, and I kind of explained it there. You can comment on any of those YouTube videos. I stream very regularly on YouTube. I try to do some historical games and stuff. And that's usually a lot of fun. We're seeing a lot more subscribers on YouTube. I think the last couple of days I've picked up around 15, 16 new subscribers. So I appreciate you all there as well. And I appreciate you guys listening once again. So I hope you have enjoyed this episode. I hope you will continue to listen and enjoy. And if you, again, any feedback, just let me know. I'm always looking for constructive criticism, feedback, anything like that. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you're excited to get into the actual progress on the timeline again. I know I am. We'll be back in Africa, of course. We'll start with kind of the sub-Saharan African regions, South Africa, East Africa, and then we're going to move towards sub-Saharan Africa in the East, and then we'll go from there. So I hope you all are looking forward to that. I certainly know I am. But thank you all again. I hope you have a good rest of your day, a good rest of your week, and all that stuff. I'll see you all next time. Peace.